Oi, you. It's time for another episode of Dorothy and the Dealer. Let's tune into the conversation.
I love some of his where he goes off on a tangent and goes, do you know the planet circle?
And then he goes, I just had a fucking handful of mushrooms.
Did they were saying yesterday with his podcast because of the election, and they offered Kamala said that she would do it if he went to her and would only do an hour. And somebody was like, the first hour is just talking about whether you have had ayahuasca. You're only just getting caught. You're only just getting like warmed up at that point. There was no way he could do thing in that time.
There's no way he's going to go outside his comfort zone of where he is.
Nah.
And then on top of that, like you were saying, the only reason she would have done an hour or 45 minutes is because that's all she's able to sustain a fucking conversation.
He would have absolutely crucified.
I think the idea, though, was he was intending just to have a conversation, not to make it about politics, not to make it about anything, but
the problem is that when the other person can't actually have a conversation.
Yeah. I mean, that hand movement thing that she does with the before and the after, and she uses this for every occasion.
Yeah.
The children should be able to have their sexual organs removed and replaced if they want, because before the sexual organs were removed, it's just... Anyway, we won't have to put up with that giggle.
No. Thank God.
That's true.
And that nonce of advice, that running mate. Did you see that? That's when you shouldn't marry cousins.
Oh, dear.
Seriously.
Yeah. I think the theme for this podcast has been set.
Okay.
Do not marry your cousin.
I don't hold back if I...
That's great.
If I'm over the top, just give me the wave.
No, we're good.
So have you seen me doing this part? Have you seen me doing this? Yeah. Right, it's your
You know
top.
We're what already rolling, don't you, right? Oh, it's well, a bit too late. Yeah,
no worries.
We've already
gone on. So... what I'm going to say is hi, firstly, welcome. We met Patrick, we met you on Friday night and you're just in from the UK, is that right?
Yeah, just
and
for a lightning visit.
Lightning visit and you're heading off, and so we thought let's grab this opportunity while we're here to have a bit of a chat.
So we're sitting with Patrick Davin, who's originally a Perth boy. But originally Irish, I just like to throw that in.
We've got to get a song in, right?
Yeah. Okay, so tell us, what is your favourite go-to song right now that you absolutely fucking love?
Or just any song that you just like?
Anything from the Eurythmics, anything from...
The Eurythmics, Jesus Christ, Pat. Well, nobody would know.
People know, I know.
But, you know,
tell me something from the Eurythmics.
Killers, I've been listening to Marty Millington's albums.
Oh, he plays Human quite often. I like that song.
Yeah, that's wrong. I love that song. Yeah. So I've fallen in love with that again.
Are we human?
Yeah, I'm anything that's not Taylor Swift at the moment. She's done three tours of London and everybody. I'm not a Swiftie, but
my daughters were Swifty for about a month. Yeah, and everything was. I'd wake up to Swift. I'd go to sleep to Swifty, and the car was Swifty. Everything was, but they've changed.
There is a band called the Nicotine Dolls, and if you haven't heard them, I don't know the names of their songs, but you know, I picked Lady Gaga when she was three, and she's been famous. And I'm calling the Nicotine Dolls now.
Really?
After this podcast, go and listen to anything by the Nicotine Dolls, and text me afterwards and thank me.
Okay,
you're just amazing.
I mean, it's good that you've done that because it seems whatever the fuck you put your hand to turns to gold. Like you just showed me a stock you had.
It's been incredibly. I've had an incredibly lucky day. Like I woke up on Melbourne Cup Day and I went to a pub and a restaurant with some friends. And recently, I've been getting numbers in my phone. Every time I pick up my phone, I guarantee if I picked up my phone now, it has running numbers. And when I looked at my phone before the Melbourne Cup. Ironically, it was 911, which is, you know, go and get help, which is probably appropriate for somebody going out gambling and drinking all the time. But the two horses I picked were 9 and 11, and 11 got up and won at 100-1. So I didn't have a particularly big bet on it, but it covered my day, that's for sure. And since I've landed in Perth, I've just, you know, I had some investor meetings yesterday, which went particularly well. I met you guys, and here I'm on a podcast a few days later. The election, irrespective of who you vote for, I think it was a good result yesterday. So, I'm lucky so far, but I'll probably get RBT'd on the way home. But then again, I'm only drinking water.
So, let's start. Can we just start? Where are you from? You said to me that you tell me a little bit about your father. You said father was grandfather was responsible for
my great grand uncle started the GA in Ireland. My father was in the RAF during the Second World War and was captured in the fall of Singapore and was in a prison camp for most of the Second World War. After the war ended, he was very ill, so he was repatriated to Perth in Australia. They took a lot of the prisoners here to recover. Mm-hmm. He fell in love with Australia at that time, but went back to Ireland, met my mother, and I've got 8 brothers and sisters, 7 of which were born in Ireland. My younger sister and I were born here. They got fed up with the Irish weather.
Right.
And my dad's, they at those days in the 60s, it was a £10 tourist. You could go to Canada, you could go to Australia, and you could take the whole family.
Right.
Particularly as a war veteran, very cheaply. So they up stumps and came to Perth, thankfully, and not Canada, because that would have been a disaster.
particularly
sorry
now.
For you Canadians out there. But then, so we came to Australia. I was born and bred here. My mother was pregnant when she came here with me. I was born and bred. We lived in, you know, the government Nissan huts out in Fremantle. When you came to Australia as a £10 tourist, you did that. I was then brought up in Gosnells, you know, to a very, very loving family, no family issues, no nothing. I didn't know the difference between black, white, green and gold, left or right politics or anything like that.
Yep.
I was taught to enjoy people and just get on with my life. Left home at an early age, went to university, dropped out of university.
How old were you when you left home?
17.
Right.
Dropped out of university because I was doing a part-time job during my university years. I was doing a Bachelor of Business, Agricultural Business with UWA. And
why did you want to do agricultural business?
I was very interested in animals and stuff, and I was putting myself through university by doing wool classing. So I'm a wool classer. I can go and see a sheep, a sheep.
Right.
Family history is sort of farming, being Irish, Irish farmers. And long story short is I ended up getting a part-time job during my university days, and it was an investment company, an Irish guy called... was Mullins Investments, and his name is Des Mullins, and I went in there and, you know, very quickly fell in love with it. You know, I was involved in the lower angle of their investments, and they wanted to invest in property and housing and farms and all that sort of thing, and I had a little bit of knowledge in that. I was very young, but I did okay in it. In that period of time, I stayed with them for about 4 or 5 years, earned a little bit of money. In that time, I also met a guy called Trevor Tennant, who's a mining guru in Perth, who used to work for BHP, and he became a bit of a mentor to me, if he sees this. G'day, Trevor. And I sort of learnt the ropes in mining. He then started a mining company called Consolidated Minerals, which was mining and exporting chromite, iron ore to China, and chromite, manganese and iron ore is what's used to make stainless steel. So China was a big customer.
Right.
I was about 25 at that stage, and they said, look, you can talk pretty well, so we need somebody to go to China, go to Japan, go to wherever. I mean, I was in Egypt for a while to sort out problems, because when shipments go abroad, typically you get paid 90% when it leaves, and then the 10% is paid when it arrives.
Right.
And in those days, the modus of operandum of the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Egyptians was just keep the 10%, which was a lot of, which in many cases was the profit on the shipment.
Right.
So they would send me in there as a young guy to go in and negotiate where angels fear to tread. You know, I was in the Sinai Peninsula in a whole lot of horrible places, and I would always come back with the money or a portion of the money.
Right.
But in doing that, I was making them a lot of money, but I was actually putting my life in risk. I remember flying into Egypt once, and the Australian government met me in Cairo and said, you know, I was travelling with a military convoy into the Sinai Peninsula, where I had to spend 3 months in a place called Abazinima. Have a look at it on a map, you know. I thought it had ATMs and people. literally had camels, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
So they said, look, if you go in there and you go missing or you're captured, or this is when there was trouble in the Middle East, we're not coming looking for you. And so you're going in of your own accord.
But they must have been paying you like a bazillion fucking dollars.
No, you know, I was getting paid well, but I wasn't getting paid a gazillion. And I was only in 26, 27. At that age, you still feel like you're pretty old. But in those days, I just, you know, I was wet behind the ears.
Yeah, gone home.
But I went and did that, survived Abazinima, but when I flew back, it's the only time I've got out an airline, honestly, it was Singapore Airlines, and I, you know, the carpet has got 3 layers of chewing gum on it, and I bent over in the airplane and kissed the carpet that I was getting out of Egypt.
Really?
Oh, jeez, what a country. Sorry, Egyptians. And
just do a blanket, sorry, yeah, to anyone.
You can edit all this out. But in the end, but it gave me a great, you know, I was in places by myself at 27 years of age that a woke kid or something of today would never consider. Yeah. But in those days, I had everything to gain and nothing to lose, so I just did it, right? Yeah. And everything I did, I was learning, you know. And it just gives you courage to go. You know, when you're in Abyssinia, and you've got 9 Egyptians that want to kill you because they've stolen $3 million of iron ore off a shipment, and you're there to get it back, and you're by yourself, and the Australian government has disowned you, you learn to, you know, operate pretty carefully.
So did you have guys with you that were armed? Did you have...
No. I had a guy with me that was armed in Cairo, because if you went to see, as a single white male, if you went to see the pyramids by yourself in Cairo at that stage, you're going to get kidnapped for sure. So I always had an armed guard with me in Cairo. But the convoy that took me to Abyssinia was a military convoy. But when they dropped me off in Abyssinia, I've got some great pictures of this. You know, they just left me on my own. And I was there for, like, you know, in this mosquito-infested, malaria-carrying dump where these guys are just refusing to pay us. And I just said, well, I'm just going to become one of you. I'm going to be Patrick of Arabia until I get the money. And eventually they gave me the money and I left.
But hold on. So they didn't have to give you the money. How did you get the money?
Well, what they do is it's about intern and outturn analysis. So when you've got a lump of iron ore, for example, and you see it in Australia was going on shipments, they crush up a sample of that, and that has whatever the elements are. So it might be 99% iron ore and 2% magnesium and 1% silica. If the intern analysis, what they do at the intern port and the outturn analysis are the same, everybody gets paid. But what the outturn people would do, they would rig the outturn analysis so it was different. And under the contracts, it would say, you know, this is different, so therefore we're keeping this as a penalty.
Right.
So what you're entitled to do as the owner of the ore is you bring in your own team of geologists and they take a sample adjudicated by an independent adjudicator and then you crush that sample and you test it and you have to be paid out on that. Otherwise you can never buy any more ore. You can't just randomly steal from people. So my job would be to get those people in, randomly take the sample, which could take weeks in some stages, and then get it to an analysis, get the analysis done fairly because everybody's paying the analytical companies. And then when that is finalised, they've then got to pay. So that's what I would do.
Right.
But I would also have to go to China and Japan because a lot of the alloys and steels and alloys and everything that were sold were to go into manufacturing. So you weren't just dealing with the person at the unloading port, you're also dealing with the person that the alloys and steels and everything have been sold onto.
Right.
Now, I forgot to mention that I was a motorcycle kid since I was this high. I always loved motorbikes. So quite often when I would go to China and Japan, the resources that were sold to the companies ended up in the motorcycle industry because there were huge industries there. So not only would I be sorting out the issues at the port, I would then have to go to the secondary user of the product, which might be a motorcycle company that's building frames or building engines, and say, look, we know that they lied about this result and, you know, it's going to have a penalty on you if you don't make sure that we're paid. That would be part of the process.
Right.
But in doing that, I noticed, and by this stage I'm 28, 29 years of age, and I noticed that there was a bit of a gap in the industry for somebody to manufacture motorcycles because I was dealing with a lot of the motorcycle companies and I said to the Chinese in particular, do you ever export? And they said, no. Our quality is never good enough to export. So I sort of framed that in my mind. I thought, if I get a chance, I'm going to come back here and try and build a quality motorcycle from China and then take on the Japanese at their own game because the, you know, the production costs in China were much less. But in the interim, I didn't have that much money to go and start that company. But I found in Australia, there was up near a town called Newman in Western Australia, there was an abandoned mine site that did stuff called chromite. They mined chromite. Now, to make stainless steel, if that didn't have chromite on it, it's not malleable. You can't. If you have steel and it doesn't have chromite in it, it won't bend, or manganese in it won't bend, it'll just crack. So steel as we see it today, and stainless steel in particular, is made of three main ingredients: iron ore, manganese, and chromite.
Right.
And chromite is the lesser ingredient, but it's also a very expensive ingredient. So with no money, I think I had...
Just make sure you're speaking into the mic for us there.
And if I'm talking too fast or too...
No, no, we're good.
Great.
With not a lot of money in my pocket, I found this mine site and I drove up to Newman with a geologist friend of mine, out right out in the back blocks of Newman, Australia, and I found this old mine site and I found that it was owned by a company that didn't realise it had any asset value. And I went and I got the geologist to look at it, and what it was like, if you can imagine a cookie, a chocolate chip cookie, this was a mountain and the baking soda of the chocolate chips was the mountain, but in the mountain was all this chromite, which I could visibly see, which was sticking out of the ground like big chocolate chips. And I said, that can't be hard to mine. If you can see it, you don't. It's not like gold where you've got to drill holes.
Dig down
You can just, we can bring trucks up here, a bulldozer up here, blast the shit out of this thing.
You're done.
And we're done. But there was a couple of things that had to happen. One, there was an Aboriginal claim over the property that they wouldn't let anybody mine it, which is a huge impost. This is going back 30 years. And the company that had it still owned the tenement and they didn't want to sell it. So I went down to Perth and said, look, I'll sort the Aboriginal issues and I'll give you money for it and I'll give you a 25% retained interest if I can get the Aboriginals across.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, good luck, you know, because in those days the Aboriginal system wasn't as sophisticated as it is now, so you were dealing with five or six different groups who were all fighting over each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a huge challenge. I'm a 30-year-old. I've got, you know, a couple of hundred grand in my bank account and I've just left my job to go out and start this operation. And it's 380 kilometres from the coast, which is the nearest loading port. Long story short, I negotiated with the Aboriginals and got them across the line, which was huge, you know. I remember being in a boardroom in Perth where the Aboriginal groups are there. I promised that 50% of the employees on the mine site would be Aboriginal. I promised they'd get a great royalty. I went up and met them and had an Avis hire car, a four-wheel drive hire car, and they turned around and said, we want that car included. And I said, okay, I'll buy you one. They said, no, we want that car now. So I had to ring Avis and say, I'm buying your four-wheel drive, and gave it to them on the day. Those sort of things happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was ridiculous. But they eventually agreed. And then I had to find a way to mine it. So I basically went up there and mined it myself with a few friends. I found somebody in China who would buy the shipment. And it wasn't an insignificant value. It was worth $2 or $3 million. And out of that, my profit margin was about $500,000. But the biggest cost was trucking it to Port Hedland, which was going to cost like $1.5 million. So eventually I spoke to all the trucking companies and said, look, if you back me, I can't pay you now, but I will pay you when I get paid. And so they were all so competitive at the time that unbelievably one of them turned around and said, okay, we trust you, and we'll do it, you know, well, on the tick. They got paid. I got the shipment done. Unfortunately, I didn't get permission from the mines department, so they said, we hear you're mining up there without the mining rights. So they said, we're going to shut you down. And at this stage, I've got this giant pile, big enough to drive a car up onto, of chromite at the Port Hedland Port Authority, ready to load onto a ship. And so the mines department said, we'll meet you there. And I said, look, I haven't mined a thing, but we drove up on top of the pile, the mines department, and sat there. And I said, tell me where my chromite is. And they thought they were driven up on a big pile of iron ore because it looked the same.
Oh, my God.
So I said, you know, you can't accuse me of mining when I haven't started mining. They were actually sitting on top of the pile of stuff that I dug up.
Hope nobody's listening.
No. Well, it happened. It's history now. I paid all the mining fees and everything subsequently, and we did many shipments after that. But I ended up getting that shipment away, paid everybody, and then we did about five or six shipments, and I made a few million dollars out of that. And then I sold that whole business, Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, to Consolidated Minerals, who was a big mining company at the time, and they gave me shares. They were public listed. It was a guy called Michael Kiernan. And basically that gave me enough money then to, you know, go and start my Vimoto company, which was a motorcycle company, so I had the capital to go and do that then.
So Vimoto, where was your first, did you first start supplying? Was it West Australia?
Yeah,
because I was with Nigel Joyce. Do you remember Nigel?
Yeah.
I was with Nigel on the weekend. He goes, oh, yeah, I know Patrick.
Nigel Joyce, he was a very successful guy in his own right.
He's my neighbour.
He was not a distributor.
He used to be in
Midland, I think.
He had a Suzuki KMX, and he ended up with Harley. He was a great, actually, as a neighbour, I'm very close to him. He's a really, really good guy. So he took a photograph at the thing on Saturday.
I didn't recognise him. Obviously, it's been 30 years, but...
So, Vimoto, then I
took an old Vespa to China and said to them, look, can we make a copy of this? And the Chinese said, yeah, we can do that. And I took a Bunnings. I mean, the beginnings of Vimoto are so funny. You know, I took a Bunnings paint thing to China because it had the colours I wanted. I wanted the ocean blue and the woke colours of today. And the Chinese said, you're not going to paint it silver and black and everything? I said, no, I want it light green, I want it sky blue, I want it this colour. And we made it. And I called it Vimoto because Vespa was the biggest in the market. I had to make sure that it didn't sound Chinese, so I just called it Vimoto. And I went up there and built the bike at a factory, and the first container came down here, and the average scooter was selling for, you know, it was a Honda, a Yamaha, Suzuki, whatever, was selling for $3,000. And I just said, look, here's a brand new scooter at $1,999. It's Vimoto. We warrantied it. I had a warehouse in East Perth. And within weeks, we were sold out. And in the first year, we outsold Yamaha, Suzuki, Kawasaki and Honda combined.
Wow. Combined.
We couldn't get containers.
What year was this, Patrick?
This was 2000 was the year we first brought them down. But 2001, we owned the market till 2006.
Right.
So it went crazy, but it was petrol vehicles. And eventually Honda said, we're not going to put up with this. You know, we're going to build. They built a Chinese-made scooter called the Honda Today, and they put it out at $19,990. And I decided, well, you know, nobody was doing electric vehicles at that time. So I thought we were big enough by that stage. You know, we were selling 5,000 or 6,000 units a year, was turning over a reasonable amount of money, spare parts and merchandising and all that sort of thing. We had franchises all around the world. I was selling into the Middle East and other countries. But we needed expansion capital, and I also wanted to get rid of the petrol engines and go to electric. And nobody was doing electric in those days. Mm-hmm. So all thought I'm mad. And then there was a surfing brand that was public listed here in Perth. I can't mention their name at the moment, but they came to me out of the blue. I mean, talk about being lucky. One day there's a bang on the door, and I open the door of our East Perth office, and there's these guys saying, look, we've got a surfing brand that's listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. We make wetsuits in the United States. Company's out of control. The ASX is going to close us if we don't put a decent asset into this company that's turning over money. Would you be interested? And I said, yes, I would vend in, but only if I could take control. Get rid of all of your surfing bullshit. Change the name. You guys, the share price was 4 cents at the time. You guys, we will take over a controlling interest more than 51%. We took 70%. And we will vend our operations in. I will become the CEO. You guys can remain as a token board of directors, and my management team comes in and takes the whole thing over. But I said, in doing that, I'll take the share price from 40 cents to $1.20, 4 cents to $1.20. So they agreed to do that, and I had to fly to America, meet all of these West Coast surfing distributors that were all just having a whale of a time on public listed money. You know, when you become a public listed company, the money in the company is not yours. Mm. You have to constantly say that to yourself. Doesn't matter if it's $5 or $10 or $20. It's not yours. It's the shareholders. Mm. And these guys were just sitting back. You know, they were taking me. I'm the new CEO, and they're taking me to lunch at VIP restaurants and saying, just put it on the company, and I'm the one that's about to sack them for it. So I'm in my early 30s at that stage, and I'm not wet behind the ears. So I did sack everybody. Had a great case where a guy stood up in Orange County in America when we sacked him and said, well, I'm shutting the whole operation down. And he physically vomited on the boardroom table. He was that stressed with it all. But then I came back and built that company up. So that went from 4 cents within weeks of owning that company, it went to 20 cents within weeks. Within months, it was at 60 cents, then it went to $1.20. So it really skyrocketed. Consequently, everybody that had invested in it had made money. So that's how you make friends in the investment community. Yeah. That's why I'm comfortable about what I'm now doing with Mute. But that was also a really big struggle because it became very, very big. I built a factory. I bought land and built a factory in Nanjing in China, huge factory, 30,000 square metres.
Wow.
And I sat there. You know, every time I was flying to China from Perth, I would drive down the street where our factory was, and every house in the street was made out of the same bricks as our factory, and the factory wasn't getting built. And I would say to the guys,
"What's going on?"
What? And they'd go, "Oh, that's it." So I realised I had to move to China, and not Shanghai or Beijing. I went to out in the boondocks of the middle of, you know, China, where I was the only foreigner, and you'd walk to a supermarket, and, you know, 50 people, you'd pick up a dozen eggs, and 50 people would pick them up afterwards and take selfies of themselves with you. You know, it was right out there. Built the factory, got that all going.
And you're producing motorbikes.
And then we're producing petrol motorbikes. And then I said, okay, stop what we're doing. We're going to electric. And everyone said, oh, this guy's totally lost the plot. And I said, look, it's all going to go electric.
What a leap, though. What a gamble.
Well, the only thing was that the market for petrol bikes, you know, when you're dealing with so many people, you're competing, you know, if you think of the amount of, you know, last year there was 4 million cars sold around the world. 40 million cars sold around the world. Last year, there was 380 million motorbikes sold around the world.
Wow.
So it's a 10 times market, and nobody was doing electric. And there was a company in Germany that I'd met that was doing electric, but they were very, very small, and I'd meet them at trade shows and everything. So I said to them, I rang the guys in Germany. I said, look, I'm coming across to see you. I said, I really like what you're doing, but what you're doing is costing you too much because you're using European salaries and everything. I said, imagine taking that, your technology, and dumping it in China and then making it at a tenth of the cost, and then we go into the marketplace. And they said, that's a good idea. So I bought their company. It was called Emax, and then transferred their assets and their technology and their engineers to China. Some of them didn't like it very much. But I then built Vimoto into an electric. And, you know, we were the first ones in the electric market. Everybody's caught up now. But the issues that I had there were, you know, as fast as we grew, and, you know, I looked at our car park when we started and it literally was full of bicycles. And within 2 years, it was full of BMWs, and in 3 years, it was full of Porsches. And I knew what I was paying everybody. But the Chinese, as much as I loved them, and I've lived there for 20-odd years on and off, 17 full-time, the local guys couldn't help but get involved in the supply chain. You know, if we're buying 20,000 tyres, you would normally go to 10 different vendors and then you would negotiate a deal with them. Mm. But these guys would take backhanders off the vendors. You know, if you're getting steel, if you're getting handlebars. And it was just, and I tried to move the team. I said, look, the procurement team has to move every 6 months because the minute they establish a relationship with a supplier, it's out of control. So although Vimoto was doing really well and it was making great money for everybody and the share price was up, I literally was a CEO of a company that which was an Australian listed company, so you're subject as a director and CEO to
everything,
all of the conditions here, where you can easily end up in jail if you do the wrong thing. And I could not honestly sit at a boardroom, and I had boardroom advisors and investors, and say, look, I have control of what's going on in China.
Mm.
And to this day, Vimoto is still listed, but has grown in sales, but the profit margin is enough to keep the investors happy, but it's not what it should be.
Yeah.
It should have gone like that. Mm. But because so many people are taking off the table,
in
my opinion, I might say, because if this goes out, there's still a listed entity. When I was in control of Vimoto, it was impossible to control that aspect of the business. I also developed in my mind that selling electric anything to anybody was ludicrous. And that came to me as a bit of a revelation because I was moving from Australia to China and I had the latest Bose and the latest this and I had the latest Apple computers and everything that were all brand new. And I said to my PA at the time, sell all of that because I'm going to China. And recently I just spent 20 or 30 grand on that. And she came back and said, well, I can get you $3,000 for that. And I said, what are you talking about? That's Bose 901 speakers. It's a giant bloody computer. It's bigger than my house. And I'm going... She said, well, that's the depreciation of electric stuff. It's moving so fast that the value is valueless. Mm. You know, you can get a speaker that size now that does the same thing as a 901 Bose speaker. So it dawned on me that, wow, I'm selling electric vehicles to people and they're going to depreciate and the batteries are going to get old and you can't remove the battery, and it's like selling a torch to somebody that has a non-removable battery. You know, you've got to dispose of the whole thing when the battery goes flat. So I thought, I've got to change this. So I said to the board of Vimoto, look, I think we shouldn't sell. I think we should create a platform where we subscribe our owners. That way we have residual income coming in all the time. We control the batteries. We control the supply chain. We control what we do at the end of life of vehicle, making sure it's recycled if we're going to be green and stuff. And they said, you're off your head, you're crazy. So I divested myself of Vimoto. They made me president of strategic business development, which is just a clever way of saying go there and say do nothing, say nothing. And I started Mute, which is Multiple Urban Transport Evolution, and electric vehicles are Mute, so the acronym was there, yep. So that's why I called it Mute. The long story there is that when I started Mute in 2015, I'd raised capital in London, and Australia's a very mining-centric country. You know, small industrial-type companies don't raise money here easily. Mm-hmm. They want to say, where's your drill results? Where's your shipping results? Yep. They're not interested. You know, it's a smart country, but they haven't utilised the technology base very much. In the UK, that's less so. You know, small industrial companies do get a look in there. So I went to the UK. I loaded up with a few million dollars of my own money to start with. And I started Mute, but it was much, much harder than I thought. You know, people just... In China, where we had a 2,000 vehicles on the road, it was acceptable and people understood it. And I used my own money to get to that level. And then I opened up an operations in Bali where we knew that there was a lot of scooters. And I had Bali... China with three locations, and then I moved to the UK and said, look, I'll open up operations here. But people just laughed at me and they said, look, people are just not going to go for this here, you know, it's wet weather, blah blah blah. But they underestimated the millennials, Gen Zs. You know, the whole nature of business now is that my generation wanted to go out and buy a car and stuff. Gen Zs and millennials don't even get car licenses anymore. You know, they just want to be able to flit into a location, go onto their computers, work from home, but have access to a vehicle, right? Mm-hmm. And I was onto that. And the minute I created a platform where they could have ease of access, immediate ease of access, and they weren't locked into anything, they could hand it back when they wanted, it just went crazy. And it's gone crazy in London ever since.
So just that...
You might need to explain
we're chatting
that
about that on the weekend. And basically... And you're obviously going to correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a platform where you have a moped, an electric bike, and which is a moped-style bike, like a Vespa-style thing, and you basically are on a payment every... You don't own
subscription.
It's a subscription payment.
It's Netflix. Netflix of moped ownership.
And then, so you're not responsible for insurance, for maintenance, for any of those things. You guys take care of all of that. And all they do is they just subscribe. They're given a bike and away you go. And if you don't want it anymore, you just hand it back. And you guys come and pick it up, take it back, service it, change batteries, put it back out into the
Exactly. So, and we do everything, you know. So all of it's taken away from you. Even a helmet, you know. If you fall in love with the idea of riding a motorbike for a while and you buy one, you've got to pay for it. You've got to have a credit card. You've got to have a credit history. You've got to maintain it. You've got to insure it. But if we give it all to you, helmet, jacket, gloves, whatever you need, insurance, and then say it's yours, and if you don't like it, hand it back at the end of the month. And what they do is they'd never hand it back. They hand it back if they're moving country. They hand it back if they got a death in the family. They hand it back if they've lost their job. But generally speaking, our churn, as we call it, is basically nothing.
Wow.
And we love that, and the customers love it. And then we sort of added things to it to make it more attractive. So
was it England that you were cutting your teeth?
No, it was China that we were cutting our teeth. I mean, in China, we already had the operations going.
And how big is the operation? Like, how many bikes would be
on? In Shanghai, we've got about 2,000 bikes, and then in a couple of other cities in Hangzhou, Suzhou, and an island off the coast of China called Dalian, we've got another sort of 1,000 bikes that are running around. The problem is with this business is that you're buying the assets up front, so you've got big asset costs, even though we're getting them at a very good price. But you're getting paid on a monthly retainer level. So the EBITDA of all of this business is great, but you have to have a lead time to be able to pay for the vehicles. Most of our vehicles we pay for in 6 to 10 months.
Right.
And then the factory gives us a 3-year warranty, so we don't have any real cost for the vehicle for till the end of the 3 years. And then we can refurbish that vehicle and put it out. It's paid for itself. It's done its job. But then we pick a portion of the market who really couldn't afford to have one of our bikes in the first place, and then we remarket it to that market. So we make it really cheap for people. The whole idea is to make a social difference and to make an environmental difference. You know, environmental is easy. It's recycling everything at zero emissions, and it's replacing an Uber ride. You know, we recently passed about 50 million kilometres ridden by our users. If you compartmentalise that into Uber rides, irrespective of whether they're electric cars or whatever, it's a massive amount of money that's been saved by these riders.
Mm-hmm.
And then if 50% of those Uber cars are petrol cars, it's a massive amount of emissions that we're saving. But on top of that, we're saving people time and effort and stress. And, you know, you can walk into our London office if you're a migrant, and you can walk out 15 minutes later and we'll have you on a vehicle, and we'll also have linked you in with Uber Eats or Deliveroo or whoever, and we'll give you a job with the vehicle.
Wow.
And we include the insurance. You have to have delivery insurance, so that's very expensive. We include the delivery insurance for the rider, who could never get it himself.
That's phenomenal.
This is a guy that's come in from Bulgaria somewhere, and he's just sitting there, and all of a sudden he's got a vehicle and a job.
Mm-hmm.
And the vehicle is used by them. They don't share it. They don't swap it. It's got a tiny little mute logo on it. It's got a GPS tracker in it. So you're not riding down the road feeling like you're a visual signage for the company or anything like that. People like to feel a little bit obscure when they're renting a vehicle, you know.
Like they have their anonymity. Do you, one of the things you did with me on Saturday was you pulled your phone out and went, oh, look, here's a bike that's stolen. We're able to track that bike. So they're trying to drive it into the Eastern Bloc.
And then
I can shut this bike down right now.
Yeah, well, we remotely track all of our bikes. That was originally, the concept was to stop them being stolen. So that's still the original concept. People don't steal our bikes anymore because we can track them. But also from the tracking, many people just forget where they left their bike, you know, like particularly after big sporting events in London. You know, on the Saturday night, we get 20 calls saying, my bike's been stolen. Then we go, no, it wasn't. Go down the street, go left, go right, go left. And they go, oh, yeah, sorry.
So I left it at the pizza shop. I left it at the hamburger joint.
But that also enables us to do things like we can remotely control the bike. So if the weather is getting bad, we have an app that tells everybody slow down. But if we really think the weather's bad, we can halve the speed of the bike, so reduce accidents.
Wow.
And then if a person doesn't pay us on the monthly, they get a 6-day spread to pay us at the end of each month. If they come to us and say, look, I can't pay you, here's the reasons why. We'll work with them all the time. People have, you know, people lose jobs, people have deaths in the family, whatever, we will work with you. But if you become just somebody's repeat offender, we can stop the bike at any time, not while they're going through a big intersection. You know, when they're home, we can see they're home, we just stop the bike and their phone pops up and says the bike will go again when you pay. GPS technology's come a long way, but also it enables us to do things like, on top of the GPS tracking with the police and everybody like, we can also help our users to, we have partners, say, in London and in Shanghai, everybody from pubs. In Shanghai recently, we actually got a doctor that joined us. We have airlines, we have everything, and these are mute partners. And on our app, if you link in with our partners, you will get discounts. So, for example, in a pub in Shanghai that all the Westerners go to, called the Camel Bar, they give us a 20% discount. And a 20% discount, you're paying sort of Western prices for alcohol and stuff in Shanghai, but we're only charging you $50 a month for your bike in Shanghai. An average soccer follower, for example, a football follower in the UK that watches 3 games and is buying booze for all of his mates, can cover in that one day the cost of his mute. So technically the mute is free.
Wow.
With his discounts. And it can actually be positively geared because the Chinese are very, very clever, and we have an algorithm that tells them which shops they stop at. So we go to those shops and set up partnerships with those shops. We know that Joe Bloggs stops at an IGA and stops here and stops there. So we immediately get a partnership with the IGA. So everywhere they go, they're getting discounts.
That is incredible.
And then we can let them see on the app when they get to zero. And so they chase zero. So they're saying to their friends, I'm paying nothing for my scooter, right? And that's pretty cool when you've gone from paying $250 for pounds for a bus pass for a month, and you've got a vehicle that's dedicated to you, and it's costing you nothing, and it's pretty unbeatable, you know.
So you have teams of guys, and that's what they do.
Not teams. We've got one or two people that do that, and that's what they do. So
you've mentioned something as well about F45. You said we hooked up with F45. And just it's the same deal.
F45 in Shanghai, and we a number of gyms in Shanghai. You go there, and we all know what an F45 membership costs. And if you're going to F45 every day, I think with F45 we only get a 10% discount. But it still adds up, you know.
Of course.
You add that 10%, and then you go to Costco's afterwards, and there's another 10%, and then you go to Joe's coffee bar, and there's another 10%. It doesn't take you long before your vehicle is free. So that's what we're aspiring to do all the time.
That's phenomenal. Fantastic. I love that.
And, you know, that sort of – they love it because the supplier, say the Costco and stuff, if you're riding along on your Mute scooter, on the dashboard on our latest models, it'll pop up. The GPS will identify that you've got a Costco down the road, and there may be five different shopping centres, but it pops up to the Mute member and says, Costco is down the road and it's 10% discount for you. You're going to go to the Costco, right?
Of course.
So consequently, it's starting to catch on because people are looking in the car parks of certain shops and stuff and saying, and we don't scattergun approach it. We selectively pick people. We don't get five chemists in a street and do 10% discount on all of them. We pick one chemist in the street and do that. And then they get serious value out of it. So we get them talking to a friend and saying, you've got to get on Mute. And that's what's starting to generate the momentum, you know, of Mute internationally. Mm-hmm. And we're now in the UK in three locations, in London, in Oxford and in Manchester. We've just opened in Belgium where we're in two locations, which is Antwerp and Brussels. We've just opened an office in Barcelona, and we're negotiating a deal in Greece at the moment, and we just sold a primary franchise into Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And really, Mute works in every different location around the world. People, you know, find a problem. I think, what's his name, the founder of Amazon is great, that he said, you know, don't try and be everything Bezos. To anybody, Bezos. Just find a problem and solve that problem. But do it better than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we've done. You know, people say, well, how about your competition? We say, our competition is people walking, people on a bus, or people buying a car. And we also get feedback on our churn rates and stuff, and our trip advisors and our everything. And everybody just goes, we just love this company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get people pulling up next to me in the street in London because they know I'm the founder and just saying, and we've got videotapes of it and everything, and just saying, you've changed my life. I was literally locked in my suburb because of my inability to move, and now I've got ability to move. I've got, you know, I don't, in London, an electric vehicle can go on bike lanes, it can go on taxi lanes, it can go on bus lanes. So you can get from A to B really, really cheaply, really, really quickly, and time saving is really important. You know, we've got a lot of people that are, got one woman who's a mobile gym instructress that I met at F45 actually, and she said, look, I'm using it to go to all of my clients. And she said, before I was using public transport, and she said, I can literally sleep in 45 minutes more and I'm home 45 minutes earlier. And she said, that, you know, hour and a half of my life is changing my life. And that's what you want. You know,
you want
to have a business that's really impactful. It's all, at the end of the day, it's still about the profit margins, but if you can be an impactful business both environmentally and these days socially, that's what people, you know, they take something and they all of a sudden they tell their friends. We don't advertise at all in the UK and we can't keep up. I said to somebody the other day, if we advertised, you know, we took out a 30-second commercial on Instagram and we had some really cool commercials made, which were a total waste of time because we couldn't release any of them because... Right. We didn't have enough bikes to supply to people. Mm-hmm. And the whole concept of mute is instant gratification. The minute you don't, the minute you say to a person, well, you're on a wait list, it's game over.
Yeah.
So you're better off just not telling anybody till you've got 10,000 ready to go. But convincing investors and everything about this, you know, they would say to me, where's your contracts? You know, what's to stop the person walking away? And I said, you haven't done your market research. A millennial is not going to come in and sign a contract. You know, like the first thing that we say to them, they say, the millennial says, where is the contract? And we say, there isn't one. What are we going to lock you into?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to get on a plane to go to Bali in 2 weeks. What are we going to do? You're going to leave the scooter at your house and get on a plane and go to Bali.
Mm.
That's not our concept. And you see them going, what's the catch?
Yeah.
And we go, there is no catch. It's just, it is what it is.
So then, there's a couple of things. One of the things you said to me earlier before we came on air, you said to me, this is a story of never giving up, Mitch.
Mm.
This is really a story of just brutal, vigorous, do not walk away from your idea, stay hard at it. Can you talk into that?
Okay, well, there's a great movie called The Founder, which has got Michael Keaton in it, and I suggest everybody sees this. And The Founder is about the founding of McDonald's. And if you haven't seen it, you'll love it. Go home and watch it tonight. And in that, Ray Kroc starts off that by saying he's a 52-year-old washed-up businessman who became the founder of McDonald's. You know, found a concept that was great. But in that, there's a great part of the movie where he's getting awarded something in the American Chamber of Commerce, and he's rehearsing his speech, and the speech is a close-up of Michael Keaton saying, you know, education is here, money is here, good looks is here, but the only thing that'll get you through business is persistence. And for years, he just persisted and persisted and persisted. With Mute, you know, with getting financial investment, I mean, the money I put in was my own personal money, but it had to have follow-up funds. And getting money in was just incredibly hard. People wanted to see contracts, they wanted to see. They disregarded everything we had in China. We've been operating in China very, very successfully, but they said that's a lot of people you'll find in business will say it's a Chinese phenomenon, you know, because there's 1.4 billion people there, a toothpick maker could make money in China. It's not the case. Right. But when I was in the UK, everybody said to me, look, my aspirations for this company have always been to IPO the company. From the day I conceived the company, I knew I was going to IPO the company. And that's a very strategic thing you've got to do. You've got to build a company structure so that when you do go to IPO, you can do it at the click of a switch. It's not like you've got a private company that's got all of those encumbrances of a private company you've got to go to. It makes it very easy to go to a public company. So I have to go and speak to investors, and I do on a daily basis. I did yesterday. I've got to do later today. And, you know, you're trying to convince them that there's a window of opportunity in this market, a huge scalability in electric vehicles. But they'll hit you with things like, if it was good, why isn't everybody else doing it? Why isn't Bezos doing it? Why isn't Amazon doing it? Why isn't Uber doing it? I don't know why they're not doing it, right? And if you're successful, they're going to copy you. Well, if they copy us, great, you know, because that's the biggest compliment you can get. But it's very, very hard to get people. And what I've had to do, I thought that the investment community would be impressed that I had built this company in China. I've got a great track record in the industry. I've taken a company from 4 cents to $1.20. But I landed in the UK just as COVID hit. And so, we had huge issues in China because we had 2,000 people that couldn't ride their scooters because the lockdown in China was very, very vicious. You know, it was literally a police tape across your door. So I ended up, you know, saying to everybody, we're going to give you 5 months off your scooter. So we lost 5 months of revenue, which was millions of dollars. But I donated all of our scooters to the nurses and the police of China. So I didn't just have them sitting around. I said, look, they're for your use. As essential workers. So when COVID ended in China, we had this huge influx of customers because they all said, and also put us in good standing with the Chinese government. But I was landed in London. I had no headquarters. I had no staff. I couldn't do a thing. And I was trying to say to people, the investment community had said, well, if you come out of China and you come to a sophisticated first world country, we will support you. So I had to wait for that lag for COVID to get over. Then I had to set up the operations. Then we were too small, you know, a couple hundred scooters in London. Wasn't big enough to entice investors. And then they said, look, could you, if you opened up a few more cities in London, we'll invest in it. So I opened up Manchester and opened up Oxford, went back and they said, it could be just, you know, you're here in London, so it's getting all your energy and so it's successful in London. So could you open up in Europe? So we went across and I opened up in Belgium, and now we've got operations in Antwerp and Brussels. Not a lot of scooters, but about 500 scooters, growing very, very quickly. And I also opened up an office in Spain because the weather was better than Brussels, and I knew that if it worked in Brussels, it'd work in Spain. It's a very cookie-cutter approach. You know?
Right.
It's not an Einstein's theory of relativity to go and now replicate what we've got in various countries. But I still couldn't get investors. So I would get the odd small investor, you know, like 10 or 15 grand or 20 grand. It just wasn't enough, and it wasn't enough to scale. And although our, you know, EBITDA margins and everything were great, if you're trying to scale and you're trying to borrow money and you're trying to go forward, you really need a big investor.
Mm-hmm.
So you go and get advisors and you get lawyers and you do pitch decks and you go into the marketplace every single day. And I would have pitched Mute to over 1,000 investment groups, whether through whatever, you know, over the last 3 or 4 years. And all of them would say, look, Patrick, we're interested in this, but it just needs to have a bit more scale, and it has to have a bit more this and have a bit more that. But there was one group which is called Tribeca Corporation, which is a huge fund in Australia, over $3.5 billion in under management, primarily invest in mining industry and stuff, but are also, I think, wanting to be seen to be a little bit green and take a little bit of adventurous investments in people like Mute.
Mm-hmm.
They took a small investment in us a while ago, and while they were interested in us, they were monitoring us, they hadn't really gone in for a big chunk of us. But recently, just before I came to Australia actually, after thousands of pitches, and also going back to them a few times and saying, look, to be perfectly honest, your initial investment in us is at risk if they're not a follow-on investment. Yeah. You know, if you look at Elon Musk, Tesla was moments away from bankruptcy, and they got, I think, $20 million injected in them on Christmas Eve in 1996. All their cars are going on fire around the world, but, you know, that investment has gone on to be, for those investors, has gone on to be a $2 billion investment. So I'm not shy of sort of rolling this out to potential investors and saying, look, guys, you know, I know what I'm doing, and this is just going to take a little bit more money. You know, we're in the black in all of our locations. The only location that we burn a little bit of money is London, and these new funds will now obliterate that. So we're profitable everywhere. And they, thank God, Tribeca has turned around at very, very senior levels, the guys that actually own the company. The middle management had almost said, look, you're on your own. But the guys that own the company, and the reason they own the company is because they're smart, said, look, we're going to support you. So now I've got a huge VC on board.
Great.
As not only an investor, but they are going to announce shortly that they're going to be our strategic investor right through to IPO.
Wow.
So as long as we adhere to what we promised them, you know, and we've given them realistic intentions of what we want to do with the money and our time frames, etc., they will hold our hand through to IPO, and the planning is that we will either IPO in Australia, maybe in Singapore or the NASDAQ, depending on the size of the company. And the timing of the IPO is probably 2026. But there are potential companies we could take over in the interim that could speed that process up.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I want to do. So, you know, the investors that have invested in us, I want to IPO the business so we can raise, you know, they're talking about the IPO being, $100 million to $150 million pound IPO. Mute's already valued at about, our last valuation was about £30 million. So our next approach is to basically, you know, hit our KPIs in the next 6 months, and then hopefully I'll be back here to talk to you guys about the IPO and talking about a prospectus we've got out. So that's where we're going.
How do you, like the fact that you said you were wet behind the ears, it took a little bit of, you know, it takes a bit of confidence to do that. What do you think is the biggest factor in you getting the confidence to be able to go to these big companies and say, hey, put your trust in me?
The honest truth is us. Prayer. You know, I'll drop that in. People don't like the religious thing, but I'm not a a bouncing around Christian maniac, but I believe in God. But I did pray a lot in all of this. But also, you listen to other people. Listening is incredibly important. You wouldn't believe it today because I haven't let you guys get a word in edgewise. But listening is incredibly important. You know, listen to people and really listen. You know, I take notes. I've got one of those remarkables, and after a meeting, I can hit a button and everything that's in the remarkable gets downloaded to my computer, and then I go back and read it at night. Reading and keeping up with everybody, knowing who you're talking to. You know, I never go into a meeting where I haven't researched the company I'm talking to backwards, and I know the last five deals they've done. Right. And if they deviate or bullshit to me at all, I'll catch them out. So you've got to do that. And back your own judgment. If you really believe in yourself and you've got that gut instinct, you've got to back that. And it, irrespective of what people will tell you, in the particular case with Tribeca, my advisors, and I have three or four of them, who are vastly more experienced than me, said, don't do this. Do not go to one of your biggest investors and say your capital could be at risk, because they'll be sitting there and saying, we don't want to be associated with a loss. Cut it off and go. So my three strategic advisors in London who are lawyers and been in the industry for years said to me, don't do it. And I said, I'm going to do it.
Right.
And I backed myself because I thought, you know, if they say no, they can only say no, and then you've got a fallback position. But if you don't know, you just don't know.
Yeah.
And so you've got to actually think that some of these people are reasonably intelligent themselves. They haven't got to where they've got by being stupid.
Yeah.
So when a $3.5 billion fund turns around and says, okay, we're going to back you, they've got an idea that they're going to make money out of this. You've proven your results. So with that, it was a very nerve-wracking thing. But you just... as long as you're telling the truth, and they can come at you from 50 different angles, as long as you're telling the truth, your story will always come out to be in the front. If you start bullshitting, you know, I gave them a presentation of the accounts, and normally in a presentation you just put in the good news, right?
Right.
Don't put any of the bad news in there. I gave them a presentation that we put together, and I said, we've got to pay this, we've got to pay this, this is nasty, we've got a 47% interest rate on this, we got this, we want to clean all that up, and your funds are going to do that. And normally people wouldn't do that. And normally they would just go, get to the door, you know, don't let the door hit you on the way out. But they turned around and said, look, the fact that you've come to us and been honest and shown us
authenticity,
the thing. And as you've seen it today, you know, I'm very passionate about the business. I'm 60 years of age, but I'm passionate, and I've also got an incredible team, just like you guys.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen, having met you guys last week, that it's all about the team. You know, you've got to have a great team.
Mm.
And if you don't have the great team, just get rid of them. You know, anybody that undermines what you're doing, get rid of them.
Mm.
They shouldn't follow you blindly. You know, you don't want to go into a room and have everybody agree with you. That's the worst thing that can happen. You want to go in there and have people say, I think there's a better way of doing this, and we can do this. And that's what I do. And I'm in the transition period at the moment now of trying to, which is a very, very big thing, trying to, you know, the heir apparent to me as a CEO is only 40 years of age. And the, you know, handing this business over to somebody who's going to be a CEO at 40 of a company that's going to list on the NASDAQ, it's a big challenge. Mm-hmm. I'll become the chairman. But you don't want to micromanage people. You want to stay confident. I've digressed from your original question, but I mean, it's just having the confidence to know your business backwards and forwards. You know, I go back to that Jeff Bezos thing. Don't have to be everything to everybody, but you have to be really, really good at the one thing that you do, and that's what we do. You know, if you're really, really good at that, people say to me, are you worried about competition? I never lose any sleep about competition.
Yeah, no. Competition's a great thing.
Yeah. And if it's there, the market is huge. You know, I've just said that there was 350 million two-wheel vehicles sold. You know, that there could be 50 people doing mute and there's still a room in the market for that. I don't lose any sleep over that at all, because I just know that what we're doing is better. We're always thinking ahead.
Have you noticed any competitors start to come up and started to...
Not really, unless you've got...
But you know it's coming, right?
Yeah, it's coming, but you need... The competition would normally come from China, but the Chinese are never going to have that approach, the empathy that you have to have for people in this business in foreign countries. The Chinese will just be driven by numbers, which in China works fine, but it won't work elsewhere. You know, you've got to have empathy for people. And... from local people, competitors in various countries, they don't have the 20 years knowledge that I've got of China. So they're always going to come in. You know, the mayor of Shanghai rang me recently and said, Patrick, I need you to come to a conference with me in Italy, you know, just sit next to me and just so I can tell them I know a foreigner. Those sort of relationships yeah. are really, really important.
Yeah.
People have said to me, you're worried about the really big guys doing it, you know, Elon Musk and all that sort of thing. If I had Tesla, I would have never sold a car. I would have just sold the rights to the car. You know, I would have done exactly what we're doing in Mute. I would have said, because you can then manage the battery recyclability and all that sort of thing and just have an ongoing lease program for electric cars. It shouldn't...
Ongoing cash.
Yeah, otherwise a car that's 3 or 4 years old, the depreciation of an electric car is so massive.
Which we're seeing, yeah.
They're worthless. You know, Hertz just sold 3,000 of their Teslas because, you know, the batteries don't come out of them. And, you know, the latest cars out of China, there's a company called NIO, which has a Tesla, but you don't buy the car. You buy the car, but you lease the battery. So the car's a third of the cost of a Tesla because you don't buy the battery, which is the biggest component, but you just drive into a station and in 3 minutes it drops the battery and the battery of the car is replaced and off you go again.
Very
and you're
clever.
250 kilometres from any station. Thank you. So, you know, competition could come, but I'm not scared of it at the moment. And, you know, if it does come, we'll just handle it when it arrives.
So you guys list, what's the vision after that? Do you want to sell out? No?
For me, it's not about the money. It's about the listing will enable us to raise a lot of capital and I want to go into the US markets. Vimoto is now selling all around the world. And I was at a traffic light in London the other day and there was 5 or 6 scooters there, and I looked across and it was Vimoto, 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 Mute, Mute, Mute. And I thought, this is pretty cool.
It's very cool.
A traffic light in London, and every scooter there was a brand I created, wow. Right? Now, you give yourself a little bit of a pat on the back when you ride off on that, and they're all electric, you know, all silent and all going off. And you want to sort of grab the rider, the little Indian delivery rider, and say, I created that.
Hello!
What you bloody talking about?
Yeah, exactly. But what I want to do is I want to take it to the US because the US is very fragmented. It's a late adapter to electric vehicles, but it's absolutely where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go into, so if we raise 50 million through the capital raise, 50 million pounds, I'll allocate, you know, 30 million of that to go in and launch into the US. And then all of the shareholders will get a great return on their investment. And then I'm just going to step back and, you know, we have programs where we're planting trees. You know, I was in York on the weekend where in 2005 we bought 1,000 trees that were this size.
Yeah.
And for every Mute that goes out, we plant a tree. And in those days, the farmers were suffering from erosion. So I went to one of the farms in York, and the guy said, I made an appointment, and he said, mate, only 80% of your trees survive, but come and have a look at them. And these trees have now gone from this to proper trees, right?
Yeah.
And he said, have a look at what's happened to the environment here. He said, it's totally changed. He said, you did that. And he said, when we planted those little trees, we thought, no way were they going to survive. And so every Mute customer gets a tree planted for them. Every Mute customer gets told where their trees are planted and how that's affecting to offset the emissions of the vehicles been made or charged. Wow. And people do that all the time, but they bullshit about that. You know, I've got pictures on my phone right now of me standing in this bloody forest that has been created by Mute and stopped erosion and a whole lot of other things.
I'm sitting here, that's fucking incredible, Pat. Like, that is really... really incredible. Like, to be able, that size and that immenseness of vision is just fucking enormous.
Well, thanks for that.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's thinking outside the square, and we're constantly looking. You know, you talk about competition, and what's the competition going to do? Bring it on. You know, because we go down to the real detail of, we know if a person says to me, you know, are your batteries been recycled and are your plastics been recycled? You know, we use our old plastic to make a range of helmets. And the Chinese said, you're mad. You know, these helmets will cost you twice as much as a helmet off the shelf. And I said, yeah, but they're not recycled, you know.
Yeah.
People talk about zero emissions. They talk about recyclability and they talk about all of that sort of thing. But How many times do you tangibly go and see it? After this interview, I'll show you the pictures. You will not believe these trees came from a punnet that size, and now they are fully grown 8 foot tall trees. And that's, you know, these farmers are going, at the time those punnets cost us $2 each, but at the time that farmer did not have $4,000 to buy trees.
Yeah.
He was in the middle of a drought, and $4,000 was what he was paying to keep his sheep and his cattle alive. Mm-hmm. So it was a total luxury to him. And I've got the pictures of me there with this thing twisting the tree into the ground and everybody laughing at us. And now I come back and it's admittedly 20% died, but the rest are absolutely thriving, mm-hmm. and will be giant trees in the future. And we're doing that in every country we're in. So we're doing that in China, we're doing that in Australia, we're doing it in the UK, you know, every month we're planting trees, and wow. people love it.
It sounds like you, like by what you're saying, you have to have a lot of trust in yourself to be able to back yourself that way, right?
Mm.
Is that, do you feel that that came naturally, or do you feel like you had to work at that?
That's a good question. I think I've had a fairly confident upbringing. I had great parents, which is a good start. And I think I had, and my brothers and sisters are all fantastic. So there's no sort of history of anything nasty in the family or my background. I think you have to back yourself and you have to get that judgment. You just have to be confident. And I don't make perfect decisions all the time. You know, you make bad decisions all the time. I've made bad decisions on locations and in relationships and investors and all that sort of thing. But you just have to say to yourself, everybody will try and put you down. And if you're sitting there with a group of financial analysts and 999 times you're told we're not going to invest in your company, you start to go, maybe I am mad.
Yeah.
But that's where I come back to that persistence is everything thing. If you really believe in it, it has to make money. You know, you can't be pushing a business where you've looked at your balance sheet, your profit and loss over a number of years and it doesn't make any money.
Yeah,
although
yeah.
you've got companies like Uber and Airbnb who have never made any money. They're just a beast on their own. They've never made a profit. You know, you have to, and when you're a small company, you have to generate a business plan that will make a profit, and the profit has to be something that will entice investors to come in. You know, they're not going to do it unless you are an Airbnb or a Uber where they're too big to fail now, so they just keep on throwing money at them, and they make money through other angles. I mean,
so I'm Patrick. I live in Dublin, and I haven't got your bikes there.
Yep.
Is it you that goes in, or if I want to bring your bikes in and start that business, how does that work?
Like a franchise, you mean?
Yeah. It really works. We keep track of every location around the world, and we have a lot of inquiries from Dublin, because the Dublin people, the Irish, come to London on the weekend, they see a mute and they say, well, it'd be great. But there has to be a certain population size. Dublin would be okay. You could do it in Dublin. You've got a really weather issues there in Dublin, because it's as horrible as it is in London, it's even worse in Dublin. Then we look at, you know, we do a study of the whole demographics and the how many people are using public transport. We just don't go in and say, you know, people get over enthusiastic. The other day I told you we sold a franchise into Saudi Arabia. That guy just came to London and said, this is going to Saudi Arabia. And when I did the stats in Saudi Arabia, I said, mate, you know, there's not a lot of people getting around on scooters in Saudi Arabia. He said, yes, but it's the future, right? And I said, well, if you want to do it, no worries, no skin off my nose. I was never going to open in Saudi Arabia. So, yeah, we don't let people become idiots of themselves. We will do the research for them and say, look, we know all the stats on public transport, car sales, electric adaptability, the government legislation in that particular country. And then if the person comes back and still wants to do it, we then have a look at them and say, what's their history? Have they, you know, opened up a pizza bar in the middle of some place that wasn't successful or whatever? And then if they still want to do it and they tick all the boxes, we'll then work with them to do it. You know?
And then so, because the first thing place that comes to my mind is, where do you think? India.
Shortest book ever written is Caucasians that they'd made.
I'm not going to say the one you sent to me on the weekend.
No.
I laughed so many times.
India's now the most populous country in the world. It's just overtaken China. but it's very insular and it's almost impossible. They have their own manufacturing processes there.
Mm.
They've got a company, I forget what it's called, but they make millions of scooters. It really beggars to, but India is a country that if you went in there, they would just, the copying of you would just pop up everywhere and it would just become a mishmash. If you could find a genuine Indian partner that had some political clout and could get a license to operate in a particular city or something, you could probably make it work. But it you know, there is so much of the open markets. In Europe, there's 1 to 2 million scooters sold a year. You're also going into markets, creating new markets. So you're not actually going in statistically on what's already there because you're creating something brand new. But India, I've looked at it and we get inquiries for it all the time. You know, there's also Mexico and Colombia. We look at crime rates in certain areas. We look at theft rates. We look at supply chain and all that sort of thing. It's still a very, very early, nuanced business. And so the Indians are making bikes, but they're not of a quality that we would accept because, you know, you know, if you start having breakdowns and issues with your bikes, that can eat in your profit margin very, very quickly. Chinese are very, very sophisticated. You know, the bikes we use are the iPhone of electric scooters. You know, we set them out and the person comes back to get their brakes checked and their tyres checked when we tell them to, but other than that, you never see them again. And, you know, they've got things like dashboards, so, you know, you're pulling up at a traffic light and then it pops up and says there's five partners near you and these are the specials for the day. And then as you go again, that drops off your dashboard, tells you all about your green mobility on your dashboard and all that sort of stuff. So it's quite sophisticated technology, and India still isn't there as yet.
Yeah. So then finally, we'll finish on this. I'm an investor. I've got money and I want to invest in the IPR. I want to invest in the stock. Where do I look?
They come directly to me. What we're doing prior to IPOing, we're allowing people to invest in the company through what's called a convertible note or a convertible debt. And the way a convertible debt works is you loan your money to the company for a period of 2 years. You get a interest rate or a coupon rate of 12% on that money, which is much better than normal bank interest, or it was, but and now that Trump's in, the interest rates will come down further, so 12% is a really good interest rate. But after 2 years, you sit there and it's a loan to the company effectively, but at the same time we issue a share certificate for you, and that share certificate is a 30% discount to the current value of the company. So the company was valued at $30 million recently, so if you got shares in it, it would be at a 30% discount to the $30 million. You're getting your interest, and then at the end of 2 years, you can then turn that into fully paid shares in the company and take your interest back, or you can turn around and terminate the agreement. If we're not doing the right thing, we haven't invested your money wisely, you can take all of your money and your interest back.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really good way. It's a new age way of getting investors in that are not fully invested. They can watch the company there. They get all the reports on the company, and we report just like a publicly listed company. We're a private company, but we do a quarterly report and an annual report and a six-month report to all shareholders, convertible note holders, whoever they are. So there's no question mark over what we're doing with the money. And if a smart investor comes in, you know, they've got a convertible note, they've got great interest, they've got 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 grand in the company, it assures them that they're going to get in at the IPO level. Because an IPO, you know, if we're going to IPO and the value of the company is 30 million and we're going to go to IPO, it's going to at least go to at least 250 million. So a person's going to get a really good return on their investment with very, very little risk and downside. You know, the company has got a really healthy balance sheet. It's got virtually no debt. It's got... the only debt it's got is the convertible note debts. And then, it's a smooth ride for people and they can converse. And we don't have a lot of them. We have, I don't know, about 30 or 40 convertible note holders. I did a capital raise through crowdfunding in London in 2017 where I raised £750,000. And then I can't disclose the amount that Tribeca has recently invested in us. It's private, but it's substantial.
Mm-hmm.
So... they still have a precursor. They have a first right of refusal of any investment that comes into the company. But a convertible note in mute now with Tribeca behind us. You know, it's a license to print money. If people are interested and they hear this podcast, just email me and I'll speak to them about it.
So what's your email address if they want to do that?
It's Patrick.
Yep.
Dot Davin, D-A-V-I-N, at e-mute.com.
Awesome. Beautiful. Stuff. Hey, you know what? We had so much fun the other night as well.
It was great fun.
It was really great hanging out. I think
I
hadn't laughed as much in a long time.
Well, it was great to see the sense of community because, you know, I'm in London and when I was up in the hills, I hadn't seen that before. It was quite, I was sort of, my jaw was on the ground going, wow.
Yeah.
And one thing I've noticed about the hills people, as I call you guys, you really, it is a sense of community. Yeah. And you, when you drive around there, all of the verges and all of the houses and all the driveways and everything are beautiful. And you can see it's a real sense of community, you know. Yeah. I don't think there's a lot of renters up there. I think there are a lot of owners up
there's
there.
There's a lot of owners. But I noticed how you ran off at the end of the night. Do you remember that?
I did.
We were all going back to my place. It was like, come on, Pat, come back to our place. And next of all, Pat's running across the park.
The thing is, the downside of having this company being international is my phone is 24/7.
Right.
And if I'm on the juice or on anything and I pick up the phone and it's an investor from Dubai, I've got to know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And it is an unfortunate thing, but as the CEO and the founder, I really have to be reasonably together most of the time.
Yeah.
And I knew that I had meetings the following day and I knew that if I went with you guys, I wouldn't have been very together the following day. To be perfectly honest.
I don't think we're going to think we were taking them back to a drug.
They weren't. It was just alcohol. But it was really enjoyable.
It was
great.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for joining us. That was really awesome.
Thank you. Sorry if I rambled.
Can I just ask one last question? Final question.
Seven.
One piece of advice you would give anybody listening today about anything, business, personal, whatever.
You know, be kind to your mother. I don't know. One piece of advice. It goes back to persistence. You know, back your judgment and just be persistent. You know what you're talking about. Back your judgment. Back yourself. In the back of your brain, you know you're okay. Don't let anybody tell you any different. You know, you are what you are. You've got to where you've got. Tomorrow's another day. Just keep on going.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. I love that. Great way to finish. Thank you so much, Patrick.
Thank you,
really
guys,
appreciate
for having
your time.
Me. I really appreciate it.
That's awesome.